on this very special evening. It is a delight to see each of your faces here and to welcome you as we come together to enter into a circle of great intention, to take our place, to engage in a conscious exchange, to listen deeply, to feed and be fed by the impressions given. And again, we dedicate our time for lifting the consciousness of the world and for ourselves. In the name of God transcendent, God omnipresent, and God immanent, the spirit of life, the divine Trinity, holy, one, yet manifested as a many. Amen. So this week we celebrated the feast in the church of All Saints Day and All Souls Day. And this is a season of remembrance of those in the conscious circle of humanity. And those who came before us, they open a door and gave a place for us to enter and showed us the way. They released a great deal of energy into the world and doubtless still do so. And for this, we are grateful and we owe them a great deal. Tonight in our remembrances, we celebrate the life of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, an extraordinary being who died in 1955. And if you recall his life, you will know that because of the constraints that were imposed upon him, his writings never really came to flourish as they do today. And we're very blessed this evening to have our esteemed friend Ilya Delio to bring his work to life and to evolve it and incorporate the thinking and the discoveries of today in his writings. The following is a passage that was written about him in a foreword to his book, Hymn of the Universe. And it was written by Her Majesty Queen Marie Jose. She says, Père Teilhard de Chardin, a figurehead in the unfolding of a new cycle in the life of mankind, moves us profoundly not only by the amazing lucidity of his scientific vision, but also by his love, his tremendous love of God, which enable him to see everywhere throughout the created universe what the majority of men are blind to, the constant presence of the Creator. Père Teilhard was far from being a pantheist, and yet he saw God, the first cause, present everywhere. And filled as he was with reverence for the material world, he lived always in direct awareness of the spiritual. The most convincing proof of what some have called the saintliness of Père Teilhard is his humility. And his humility is the pledge of the greatness of his love. So a figurehead in the unfolding of a new cycle of the life of humanity. We are grateful to you, Père Teilhard, for opening our eyes to the majesty of life and to honor and the way to honor our life and all life. May we too be a part of this new cycle of humanity. Now we prepare ourselves in a very deep and collected way to be present this evening, to enter into a time of Lectio Divina, to realize the rare privilege that we have. How many people would be interested in these ideas? How many people would embrace them put them on and live by them? Will I play my own part? Will I work for the future? Now we place ourselves here and now with intention and immanent trust, taking perhaps all the heaviness of life and lifting it in hope and in love, in the midst of our own vulnerability and helplessness. With back upright, stilled and contained, we scan our bodies, perhaps noticing and then letting go of any points of tension and constriction, any points of resistance. We breathe in deeply, all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything. Everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that inspired and brought joy and hope, all affirming, all denying. And we hold it as offering, reconciled as food for being. We lift it and ask that all be transubstantiated in our being as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything, and we breathe out this healing light into the world, all worlds. I now hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I yield to the divine human life. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And now we enter into our time of Lectio Divina and our passage will be read three times with silence in between each reading. What we shall be has not yet been revealed. We do know that when it is revealed, we shall be like Christ, for we shall see Christ as Christ is. The body of Jesus, like every human body, is made from cosmic dust, birthed in the interior of ancient stars that long predated our planet and solar system. The iron that ran through his veins, the phosphorus and calcium that fortified his bones, the sodium and potassium that facilitated the transmission of signals through his nerves, all made the incarnation a truly cosmic event. Jesus participated in the unfolding of life and the emergence of consciousness, just like another human being. His humanity is our humanity, and his cosmic earthly life is ours as well. And in Jesus, something new emerges, a new consciousness, a new relatedness, a new immediacy of God's presence, a new unity in creation, a new heart to humanity, a new sense of what it means to belong to the cosmos. This radical new way of life anticipates what will take 2,000 more years for science to discover. Life in the universe evolves towards greater unity, a process that encompasses suffering, death, and new life. Jesus's entire life points to a new future in God. Jesus shows us what it means to be a human person and the way to deepen our humanity towards the fullness of life. His humanity is our humanity. What took place in Jesus' life can now take place in our own. What we shall be has not yet been revealed. We do know that when it is revealed, we shall be like Christ, for we shall see Christ as Christ is. The body of Jesus, like every human body, is made from cosmic dust, birthed in the interior of ancient stars that long predated our planet and solar system. The iron that ran through his veins, the phosphorus and calcium that fortified his bones, the sodium and potassium that facilitated the transmission of signals through his nerves, all made the incarnation a truly cosmic event. Jesus participated in the unfolding of life and the emergence of consciousness, just like another human being. His humanity is our humanity. His cosmic earthly life is ours as well. And in Jesus, something new emerges, a new consciousness, a new relatedness, a new immediacy of God's presence, a new unity in spirit, in creation, a new heart to humanity, a new sense of what it means to belong to the cosmos. His radical new way of life anticipates what will take 2,000 more years for science to discover. Life in the universe evolves towards greater unity, a process that encompasses suffering, death, and new life. Jesus's entire life points to a new future in God. Jesus shows us what it means to be a human being and the way to deepen our humanity towards the fullness of life. His humanity is our humanity. What took place in Jesus' life can now take place in our own. What we shall be has not yet been revealed. We do know that when it is revealed, we shall be like Christ. For we shall see Christ as Christ is. The body of Jesus, like every human body, is made from cosmic dust, birthed in the interior of ancient stars that long predated our planet and solar system. The iron that ran through his veins, the phosphorus and calcium that fortified his bones, the sodium and potassium that facilitated the transmission of signals through his nerves, all made the incarnation a truly cosmic event. Jesus participated in the unfolding of life and the emerging of consciousness just like another human being. His humanity is our humanity, and his cosmic earthly life is ours as well. And in Jesus, something new emerges, a new consciousness, a new relatedness, a new immediacy of God's presence, a new unity in creation, a new heart to humanity, a new sense of what it means to belong to the cosmos. His radical new way of life anticipates what will take 2,000 more years for science to discover. Life and the universe evolve towards greater unity, a process that encompasses suffering, death, and new life. Jesus' entire life points to a new future in God. Jesus shows us what it means to be a human being, a human person, and the way to deepen our humanity towards the fullness of life. His humanity is our humanity. What took place in Jesus' life can now take place in our own. And so it is. You're now invited to share with us what you received from this passage, from the image. Stephen, good evening and welcome.
Well, this is kind of a merging of the Lectio Divina and the Visio Divina again. The picture of Christ focusing on the left eye looking at us. I mean, it's almost like it's a raised eyebrow. It's kind of, you know, what I know. You're made of what I'm made of. It's this sort of an eye look of self-remembering. You remember this, right? You're part of me. You can be me. And that's the grace of it. And then there is the effort part. So you know that you've got to work. You've got to do something. It just doesn't. And we were talking in the Beelzebub class this week about legomenisms and how it imparts knowledge. But you know what? You just can't. You can put it vague inscriptions on things, but if people can't receive it, if they don't work with it, it's just an antiquity. It doesn't mean anything. So I'm kind of more of a fan of subjective art than objective art, because you've got to vibrate with what's now. And I think rediscovering our obligonian, reorienting our thinking to an obligonian sense of purpose in the ray of creation is just changes everything, just changes your orientation of, you're not clinging anymore. You're just part of it. and you see it more spatially. So I'll stop. But
yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Jeannie, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, I was touched by the words as well as the image, giving me a new sense of what it means to belong to the cosmos. What struck me was the ear. And the scripture, let them who have ears to hear, let them hear. And the ear, the inside part of the ear, has this part that I'm not sure what it's called, but it's facing in three directions so that we can get our orientation in our vestibular system and our proprioception can work. And so that ear was really prominent in this image. And then those rays, it just dawned on me that the halos kind of connect the head to the cosmos and back. I really want to read that passage several times and ponder more this greater and this idea that the greater unity encompasses suffering, death, a new life, a new future in God. So that's.
Yes, thank you, Jeannie. Thank you. Oops. Jim, excuse me, Jim, welcome.
Thank you, Marianne. Through the second and third reading, I was drawn to remember John 10:10. I have come to give you life and give it to you to the fullest.
Yes.
And I, through the eyes of my heart, became more closely connected to a deeper understanding of the depth of what those few words really mean. And I loved the first part of this reading that you shared, which inferred that you're on an adventure and you're not quite sure where the stepping stones are. And so you can't see this through the senses, but you can sense it through the heart. And it came to my mind that the eyes of my heart were being enlightened by this passage. So thank you.
And thank you, Jim. Thank you, indeed. Jim, you were there for a moment. Did you have something to share? And then you'll be our last sharing if you'd like to. I think that you're muted or if you're speaking. And yes, there.
I was struck by the how the passage relates our humanity to Jesus's humanity and his body to our body, and through Jesus our relatedness to all of the cosmos. So he becomes kind of the linchpin there.
Yes, he did. Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Well, now it is my delight to introduce our special guest this evening, Ilia Delio, who will speak to us of holism, being intentional beings in an unfolding universe. Ilya, I am delighted that amidst your very full life and your own fullness that you have chosen to spend some time with us. And we're very grateful and welcome you here among us once again. Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. And thank you for having me this evening. That was a, I did love the reflection myself. It's something I think about all the time, this life of Jesus. But I have been working, and so this community this evening is the happy recipient of several months of really pondering this question of God and our lives and the union of God and human life as we see in Jesus and as we might question in our own lives. But to get to that, the story of Jesus, so every time I hear, you know, something about Jesus, we all, it has a narrative to it. You know, we are storytellers. So Christianity, like Judaism, like Islam, they all have narratives to them. And so we have a narrative, and, you know, we know that because when we come up to Christmas, that narrative really comes into focus. You know, God so loved the world, God sent his only son, and we have the birth of Jesus, and it's beautiful. But we are in need of a new narrative. The old narrative is beautiful, but it really no longer functions to really energize us for something more. And so my work has looked to science. So we spoke about the cosmos in the prayer. And I want this evening to explore what I'm calling a new narrative of relational holism. And so this evening, we're going to kind of enter into this new understanding, this new paradigm, largely through science. And then tomorrow evening, we'll try to understand what is God in this new paradigm and what are we? And then on Saturday, my last question will be, is what is death in this new paradigm? So that's the big picture. So maybe I can just begin by sharing all 78 slides. Now, don't get nervous, but a lot of them are pictures. But I hope we can enter into something that I think is really quite exciting. Let's see if we can find it. So I'm calling this the body entangled world. We can call it the myth of relational holism. As we have here, the myth, a myth is a sacred story. So a myth is not just something that's made up. It's a story that has profound sacred meaning for our lives. So myths have always been part and parcel of the human person, going way, way, way back to the Neanderthals and into the early Homo sapiens. We have always devised myths. And myths change as our understanding of the world changes. And the new myth that I want to explore takes what the ancients would call the book of nature. But the book of nature is not separate, in my view, from the book of scripture. I think the book of nature is the book of scripture written in a slightly different way. And so what does it mean to read the book of nature as the book of scripture? And what does this mean for us in terms of experience? Reading is an experience itself. And how is science a book? What does the knowledge of the natural world tell us about ourselves and about God and about this person of Jesus the Christ? So I always like to begin the story with our universe, because this universe is such an incredible story in itself. And in our reflection, we read and heard, beautifully read, how Jesus emerges from this long process of cosmic evolution. And so it's a 13.8 billion year old process that we keep finding or hearing about new findings about its early origin, about dark matter, about dark energy. It is truly astounding that after such an immense amount of time, in fact, time itself being something that is dynamic and part of space, that we're here at all, we humans, to be able to talk about it. I think perhaps our biggest change today, our biggest paradigm shift, is really coming about because of physics, the study of nature itself. And in the early 20th century, we began to realize that what we call matter is really energy, right? We can thank Albert Einstein for that great insight, but he alone wasn't the only one. Many others helped devise this understanding. So we entered into the early 20th century, entered into a revolution. And really, it's a revolution of matter. And basically, I think matter is the key to the whole thing. Matter is the mystery. And I would go so far to say is matter is the mystery of God. But we have to work our way into what that might mean for us. But what we do know is that in the early 20th century, as we began to realize that matter and energy are interconvertible, that the world is really made of energy fields, that there really are no substances, there are really events. And these events, even at the atomic level, are part of a dynamic activity. Space and time, or space-time, is something that unfolds. And scientists tell us this is a deeply interrelated or interconnected universe. And that's one of the things I think we're beginning to see today, is that the word individual is becoming less and less relevant to the world of radical interdependence. We humans, as we will see, we are, if we trace our roots all the way back, we are embedded in layers upon layers of entangled energy. And of course, if you followed the Nobel Prizes this year, you'll know that one of the prizes in physics was given for divine entanglement. That is a really fascinating phenomenon. But let's just take for a moment the fact that, it's really interesting the way we treat material entities, whether it's persons or the things of nature or anything in our home. We can touch something like a desk or a pen, and we think we know what a pen is or what the desk is. We think we know what matter is. But if we were to trace these objects all the way down to their roots, it would look something like this. And that, and these are just mathematical formulas to describe interconnected fields of energy. Max Planck, the famous physicist in the early 20th century, said, I devoted my life to the most clear-headed science and to the study of matter. And I can tell you, as a result of my research about atoms this much, there is no matter as such. Well, that's a really fascinating statement. There is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. In his view, this mind is the matrix of all matter. So Planck was one of the early physicists to recognize the intricate relationship between mind and matter. Up until the 20th century, almost everyone thought that mind was something distinct from matter. But what we are beginning to realize is that matter is really not matter. The basis of matter is non-material. It's more like a fullness of potentiality or superimposed energy states. And that makes matter really very interesting. You know the old adage, you know, what you see is what you get. Well, that no longer holds. What you see is not so much, maybe not what you get. There's something more there. Entanglement is this strange phenomenon that actually now describes all particles in the universe, pretty much. And I know I've talked to you before about this, I'm sure somewhere along the way, that, you know, particles that have interacted and then been separated and then measured. So if we take two particles, like two gloves, you know, a left glove and a right glove, they form, you know, two hands, or you might say one whole pair of gloves. And then you separate them and put one particle on a desk here in the US and the other particle on the moon. If I change one particle, the other particle on the moon will change reciprocally and almost instantaneously. So we call this non-local action at a distance. So everything, what entanglement says is that everything affects everything else. And this is really an important phenomenon, I think, for us today to really consider. This is an example of entangled particles here, which is really a fascinating thing. Like, even as far apart as you can separate them, they will interact. Because there's no such thing as empty space in the cosmos. It is filled with all sorts of energy. So we know this now about matter, that it's really kind of not matter. Matter, the non-matter matter. And the only way we can say anything about anything is really from consciousness. Now, I know you've done a lot of work on consciousness, so I'm just going to speak only from the point of physics. But it's really quite interesting insofar as what we call the hard problem of matter. We can't say anything about matter, or as Bertrand Russell says, we know nothing about the intrinsic quality of events except when these are mental events that we experience. In having conscious experience, we learn something about the intrinsic nature of physical stuff. For conscious experience is itself a form of physical stuff. And I think that last section there, that last phrase, conscious experience is itself a form of physical stuff, is very, very interesting and relevant here. And again, Planck's, you know, idea that matter is derivative from consciousness. We can't get behind consciousness since everything that we talk about begins with consciousness. So consciousness is fundamental to matter, and matter is fundamental to consciousness. So we can say in the beginning was consciousness. Maybe that word of God, as we read in John 1, is you know, is precisely this, which is very hard to say what consciousness is. Niels Bohr said that consciousness is the wave of the wave particle duality. Michio Kaku, a Japanese physicist, says that consciousness could be a type of relationality, could be the overlapping waves that include communication and the flow of information. No one knows what consciousness is. but everyone agrees that consciousness is fundamental to everything else. So Teilhard, and thank you, Marianne, for reading that beautiful preface to Teilhard. Teilhard, the Jesuit scientist, he was an evolutionary biologist, but what really drew Teilhard's attention was the fact that matter, like dirt, rocks, which he handled pretty much every day in his day job, it had a quality that could not be completely reduced to analysis or description. And Teilhard wrote that matter is the matrix of consciousness. Matter is the matrix of consciousness. That point alone means that if we are to talk about consciousness, we are talking about matter. And that's very interesting. You know, does my computer know that I'm, you know, talking right now? So the idea of conscious matter, all matter, having a level of consciousness is very, very intriguing. Teilhard said that consciousness born of matter is always advancing in the direction of spirit. Spirit is the higher energy portion of matter. In other words, matter is not matter. Matter is energy. Energy at its root level of information is consciousness. And the highest portion of that energy, or you might say energy moving slowly enough to be seen, is spirit. These are all interconnected and interrelated terms to speak about the one reality. So what's interesting is that consciousness is an irreducible feature of reality and therefore must occupy a fundamental place in any credible world of matter, energy, space, time, and numbers. And this in itself is world change. It's a paradigm change from our traditional paradigms, which I will definitely say more about as I work my way into this. What's interesting is that the human brain, at its most basic level, is a quantum system. And so this processing of what we call consciousness is something that is in tandem with the larger environment, with the cosmos itself. And so there is this incredible integral relationship between matter and mind. And in fact, matter may indeed be the mirror of mind itself. You know, it's almost worth at some point just to reflect on the deep mystery here that is being revealed by science in this relationship of what we have thought we have known to be what matter is. And now this primacy of consciousness, of mind, but the primacy of mind is the reality of matter. So matter is like a mirror. And the great paradox of matter is that it is not being, but non-being. Now, someone can say to me, but I know when my matter is breaking down, you know, when my blood pressure goes up or my heart hurts or I stub my toe. But every experience is being registered by consciousness. So we don't really know how these things work together, but what we can say is that matter is reflecting what the mind is experiencing. And so when we look into the depths of matter, as someone said, we find that our vision plunges us into the infinite that lies beyond us. That's actually Teilhard who wrote that. When we look into the depths of matter, we look into something that is way more than what we think we are perceiving. So matter is a mirror. The being in matter is the being of matter. So that which makes matter a mirror is something of the mind reflected in the mirror. Now, this is really interesting. We can't separate our minds from that which we be, that which we call matter, or which we behold or touch as matter. The mirror image of matter and the mirrored image of the one who sees are the same. So matter just reflects back to us what we are giving it. And I want you to hold some of these ideas in mind when we come to speak about God and the person of Jesus the Christ. This is a picture here on the right of the artist Jasper Johns, who in his own way perceived the mystery of matter as the mirror of the mind. So the mirror image of matter does not only come from the other, but it receives its being from the other, which is the mind. So without the other, without the mind whom it mirrors, matter would virtually cease to exist. In fact, it would not exist. Without the mind, it would be impossible to say anything about matter. And without matter, we can't say anything about mind. So matter doesn't separate us from the world of essences. It's only by working our way through matter that our minds can expand to the God dimensions of the universe. And this, I think, is an important point, especially in Christianity, that really posits the incarnation as a central feature of religion, that God takes on matter. God becomes flesh. So all we're saying for now is that what accounts for the human mind is active in the universe. So right here, you know, we see that we are not just separate individuals. We are part and parcel at a fundamental level of what we do call cosmic life. Now, a lot of the model of relational holism finds its inspiration in the physicist David Bohm, who wrote his book, Implicate Order, in 1980, so relatively recent. Bohm was an original thinker. And again, as a physicist, he said, space is not empty, it's filled. And it's the ground for the existence of everything, including ourselves. The universe is not separate from the cosmic sea of energy. So energy is the name of the game, right? Energy is what is the basis of everything else. Bohm basically said that, you know, reality is always seen as a whole. And that's the funny thing, is we always perceive everything as a whole, which is something that Teilhard himself recognized. We can't ever get out of the whole. And it's a question of what makes for the whole. And the way Bohm described it is that matter, reality, and consciousness are related. So at every level, there's a mental pull and a physical pull. He says, but the deeper reality is something beyond mind or matter, of which both of which are only aspects that serve as terms for analysis of the whole. What is the whole? And I think that term, the whole, has really become a lens for me. We have developed a world of partials, of kind of slivers or fragments. And yet on a deeper level, we know ourselves to be part of a whole. So Bohm says, ultimately the entire universe has to be understood as a single undivided whole in which analysis into separate or independent existent parts has no fundamental status. And of course, this notion of undivided wholeness means that every system today really needs to be completely reorganized. They no longer work, which is really part of the difficulties of the world in which we're living. Bohm also, you know, recognized that consciousness is much more of the implicate order than its matter, yet at a deeper level, matter and consciousness are actually inseparable and interwoven. So we're always being conscious of the whole, which is its primacy, but that consciousness and materiality are inseparable. So we humans are a little universes. Each person is sensed is the universe on the level of self-reflective consciousness. And therefore each of us is enfolded. We're like little holes enfolded into the larger whole of the universe. So we can say we are the thinking portion of the universe. We are everything the universe is on the level of self-thought. That is an incredible mystery. And it is different from what the ancients knew. The ancients lived in a two-tiered or a three-tiered universe. So when the psalmist prayed, when I look at the heavens and the moon and the stars which you arranged, there was a sense that the heavens and the moon and the stars were separate from us. They were beyond us, something that we might aspire to. But here we're saying that everything the moon and the stars and the sun are, we are. We are the moon. We are the stars. We are the sun, now on the level of self-reflective thought. So Bohm went on to say that everyone, every single person is the thinking universe. And therefore, if we trace consciousness all the way down, we see that humankind is one, precisely because our fundamental physical basis in the vacuum matter is one. He says, and if we don't see this, it's because we are blinding ourselves to it. I don't think the onus is on us. I think our systems have allowed us and secured us in separateness. And this has been actually to the detriment of our world. So he says, we are all linked by a fabric of unseen connections. This fabric is constantly changing and evolving. This field is directly structured and influenced by our behavior and by our understanding. So we live in an undivided whole. This is Bohm's implicate order. What does it mean to be part and parcel of an undivided whole? One of the saying that I use probably in every talk, because I think it's so wonderful and I wish it would be our reality. As human beings and societies, we seem separate. And we want to talk a little bit about the illusion of separateness. But in our roots, we are part of an indivisible whole and share in the same cosmic process. So Bohm says that individuality is only possible if it unfolds from wholeness. That's worth thinking about. You know, where do we find the sense of our own personal persons, our individuality? And he says, what is needed is to learn afresh, to observe and to discover ourselves the meaning of wholeness. And I think never before has this more urgency for us. What does it mean to be part of the whole? Ego-centeredness, he says, is not individuality at all. It's actually a constriction of the whole. It wants to cut the whole in half, which actually creates for an artificial existence. So even Neil deGrasse Tyson says we are all connected to the earth, to one another, to the rest of the universe, and we are in the universe and the universe is in us. Great. So the whole is in movement. And this is really what evolution is about. This is my friend Bruce Damer from the University of California, who's one of the leading scientists on the origins of Earth life. And it is really fascinating that we might live in a 13.8 billion year old universe, but our Earth life is about 4.2 billion years old and probably came from asteroid collisions. In other words, the rock and dust from an asteroid collision. And that the earliest formation of life is among stromatolites, which immediately have formed, you can see this rock formation here, into small communities, and probably in heated ponds, like parts of the earth. He does a lot of his studies in Perth, Australia, New Zealand. These are parts of the earth where probably earliest the origins of earth life began. So the way, and I won't go into this here, but the way these small particles come together and form little gels, little communities, and create the conditions right for life to begin. And here we are after many, many thousands, millions of years of evolution. We humans have gone through morphic changes, mutations, cataclysmic events to arrive at the species that is ours, Homo sapiens sapiens. And through all this process of evolving life, there has been a reformation of matter and mind, that as things get more complex, we use the word complexify in our reflection, consciousness increases, the amount of information increases, and we become more unified as persons. So the evolution of consciousness, as Sri Aurobindo, Teilhard, I'm sure Gurdjieff and others have recognized, is the central motive of our earth life. That's so interesting, right? You know, it's not just materiality. So it's not just about being DNA or RNA or genes or oxygen or nitrogen. We are conscious material life. And therefore, we humans in evolution are part of a process. And I think this is something it's hard to get our heads around, because when I listen to how we frame our questions or our stories, we are so used to thinking of ourselves as single individuals that exist in or on Earth, in a cosmos, that we think of ourselves as people who live and who die. And yet what we don't realize is we are part and parcel, literally, of a long cosmic process. We are part of a very dynamic, energizing process. And we are evolution on the level of self-thinking consciousness. So we are unfinished. Death is probably our deepest reality, quite honestly. But as we create, we are being created because we're constantly moving towards something new. And of course, life evolves by its creative power and never turns back. There's no redos, there's no reruns. There is simply always moving forward. And again, you know, what science is holding out for us is that we are living in a radically new world of matter. Matter, mind, and the way these unify into something more. So I might call it the matter, mind, and the moreness of life. To the point where actually we're beginning to redefine what it means to be human. In fact, I would not be surprised if the term human person gives way to another type of description of biological life in the not too distant future. Giles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, who are two postmodern philosophers, have begun to look at rhizomes. Rhizomes are a type of vegetation, like mushrooms, or I think, or rhizomic life, that are deeply interconnected, like a web, like a spider web. So some philosophers speak of rhizomic subjectivity, where there's no, in other words, the person, as we have known the person, as we've grown up with that person, is giving way to a different type of transpersonal or interpersonal or interbeing. We hear these different terms that is distinct from any kind of universalism, because it's grounded in this sense of belonging. It's an immanent belonging, like being accountable, being part of a community and a people. You know, honestly, I see rhizomic subjectivity more pronounced in Gen Z and Gen Alpha Omega, which are the youngest generations right now. You know, these young generations are born into a networked world. So the mind is already primed for rhizomic subjectivity. And that's what, you know, the brain, as we know, is very plastic. It will change. And so, you know, quite honestly, we are living right now with mutations of the human person, and they're probably your children. we don't think about this, but it is part of some of the tensions that we experience and some of the difficulties we experience in culture. All of this to say is that rhizomic subjectivity is a new way of acting. If we are part and parcel of cosmic material life, it means that the human person is no longer the sole agent of action. Rather, what Karen Barad and others called, there's like an intra-acting. Everything is now acting on everything else, sort of the equivalent of divine, of entanglement. So we are ethically responsible because our actions, our intra-actions have impact. We are acting on things and things are acting on us. We are acting on people and people are acting on us. And it's a different way of approaching everything that is taking place within our midst. So this term intra-action here, I think, you know, if we were to think of this kind of paradigm here, say if these were two entities or two persons, There's no between here. It is rather that the entanglement of these particles or persons is such that one is affecting the other, and therefore they're co-constituting. That's in a sense what interaction means, is we are co-constituting one another. We can't really speak anymore about personal formation, because personal formation is really interpersonal formation. We are forming one another as we interact with one another. And that interaction results in personal formation insofar as we diffract from one another, which is what this strange looking image shows, that as we constantly interact, we're also diffracting. We are affecting and being affected by, and that being affected by diffracts or you know, splits open one from the other. And so what we can say is that, you know, at each moment we are to be alive to the possibilities of becoming. This is our ethical call. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we're beginning to realize is that we used to speak about becoming as if something were taking place up ahead. It is rather that every breath is a breath of becoming. Every moment, every thought is a moment of becoming. Every action is an act of becoming. So it's this kind of intra-acting, diffracting is written into the very matter now of being and becoming, which means that everything about us is affecting everything else, which means we have to meet the universe halfway, Bharat says. We have to take responsibility for the role we play in the world's differential becoming. We are the world, in a sense, in what it's becoming, and we shape the world in our interbeing becoming. So it is a world of experience, right? And so thought, we are shifting, in a sense. In some ways, we're shifting from the left brain to the right brain. It's not so much that, and I see this actually between generations. I think, again, if I think of my undergraduates who are 18 and 19 years old, experience is everything. And they'll often say, you know, many young people doubt things unless they can see them or experience them. And so interacting with matter is becoming part and parcel of the new reality. And, you know, every interaction has a pointer to it. It's a sign, it's pointing to something. And so it's a type of human becoming today that has become more consonant with the cosmic whole. And therefore, I think if we ask, well, what is the human person? Even though we exist as individuals, it seems to be individuals, our root reality is anything but separate and isolated. We are more like eddies in a stream, like in this flow, this great cosmic flow of life. We are matter energy complexes. Each of us is actually affecting through our thoughts, through our feelings, through our just beingness, everything else. We are radically immanent insofar as we're deeply rooted in this cosmic life. And yet there's something about us, excuse me, that's more. And I like this picture because there's something that's pulling us, just like my computer here, pulling us, right? Transpersonal, beyond the person. There's something about us that is seeking. So we're a part of nature's becoming, and we long to become something more. We're deeply relational, and yet we're complexifying into something more. And the question is, what is the more that we are complexifying, and where are we going? What are we about? So Beatrice Brutot says, a person is the creative activity of life as it projects itself to the next instant. She speaks about the I as God's creative activity. And I don't want to bring God too quickly into the picture here because I want us to really appreciate this cosmic wholeness, this interwovenness, this deep materiality that is itself the mirror of the mind. It is much more exciting and engaging than I think any previous understanding of the human person. What we are not is autonomous, independent subjects. And I think this term independent, I'm independent, no one can tell me what to do, that kind of cutting oneself off from the whole is actually detrimental to the life of the whole. So I was actually thinking about our Declaration of Independence and how we might rewrite, you know, the very constitution of our country. But this is Leonardo da Vinci's The Vitruvian Man. This model of the independent, the liberal subject, right? The one who is the self-thinking subject. This is the subject that's actually been overturned by modern science. This is a great, he was a genius, Da Vinci. This kind of understanding of the human person is actually what has landed us in a lot of our problems today. And I guess it's part of the evolution. We have to grow into a new understanding, which is where, you know, the new science is helping us. And of course, this is what Teilhard realized, that we are beginning to discover that there is ultimately no separation within the field of existence. We belong deeply to this world and to this each other because we belong to the whole. And without, you know, going too much into anything, when we talk about religion, we are not talking about a set of beliefs. We're talking about the root ligament of the cosmos itself. So the religion begins on the level of the Big Bang. It's the interiority of matter is mind, and the root of mind is what religion's about. So as we look through this process of evolution, this rise of consciousness, this rise of complexified matter, the mind begins to develop a sense of something that is more. And so we can shift, we can look back in the ages, you know, and realize that there was a time where the early primitive human, and by primitive, I mean in the archaic ages. And archaic, I want to be careful here because pre-axial religion is a type of consciousness or awareness of spirit or spirituality that is rooted in an understanding of cosmology and community. Pre-axial religions are typically tribal and storytelling. They're mythic and ritualistic, but they're also very communal. So they haven't gone away. I mean, we find pre-axial religion today among the indigenous people. Native American spirituality is a pre-axial religion. But you know that the evolution of life brought us, because of urbanization and because of the development of cosmology, brought us into a new period known as the axial period, where the human person as person emerged. And that is the person as, you know, self-thinking, as subject, as one who can experience freedom, as one who has a sense of God. So axial religions are Christianity, Judaism, Islam. So we're coming out of the axial period. That's all that we're to say here. And we are living in the second axial age, the age of deep relatedness, the age of immanence, the age of ecology and global consciousness. And actually religion is really the thing that is both in transition and can't quite find where it's supposed to go here between the axial and the second axial religion. And we have to go back and say, well, what does it mean to have a sense of religion? What does it mean to be bound spiritually, to be in relationship with a transcendent power that we name as God? So this myth of relational holism really seeks to, really my whole pursuit is not only the question of what are we humans in this great cosmic story, but what is God? And therefore I think, you know, this notion of holism, where the wholes are greater than the sum of the parts, that's really what holism means. And the fact that we are each a holon, a whole that's part of a whole, means that we're part of a reality that is, we are included in that reality, and that reality is part and parcel of us, and we contribute to it by our own lives. It is to say that a holistic worldview, I think, calls for a new type of religious thinking. So we're saying that the world is an integrated whole and that everything is connected to everything else. And we can say this intellectually, we can say this in a cognitive way, but to know what it means, to live it, to actually live in a holistic worldview is our challenge. So I'm just going to skip here, because really what I want to say is that we are moving into a new understanding of the person as a holonomic person, a person who knows oneself as part of a larger whole. And that means living in relational wholeness, where matter, person, earth, and God are all part of the whole, brings us to a whole new understanding of then what do we exist for? What do we believe? And what is God here? Is God the creator of the whole? Is God the one who brings the whole into being, or is God part of the whole, the whole of the whole? And that's, you know, a little bit of the mystery. This is just to say that religion is concerned with nature itself, the place of ultimate concern. And the function of religion is to create stories of mythic depth. That is, in a sense, what I think we need. We need a new story to help bring together all the very different facets of our lives into a meaningful relationship that empowers us and moves us forward. So Panikkar, who was a great thinker of the 20th century, says, you know, religion is not an experiment, it's an experience of life through which one is part of the cosmic adventure. I like that, because I think that's very true. There's a sense of we are here, we're gathered here this evening because there's something that pulls us into wanting to be connected, to know more, to love more, to be more. So Panikkar says, you know, that discourse about God is radically different from every other discourse. God is not an object. I think we know this, right? God is not just an object of our attention. That would make God nothing more than an idol. Says God is so great that the greatness precludes existence. That's Panikkar, the mystic, right? God is beyond even what we can think about God. So, you know, as Meister Eckhart, that great Dominican mystic, said, the ultimate and highest leave-taking is leaving God for God. Or I pray God to rid me of God, right? We have to leave our notion of God for an experience of that which transcends all notions. And that's the key, I think, here. This experience of that which transcends all notions, that it becomes a wordless experience, an ineffable experience, an experience of the whole. And, you know, if I were to say, what grabbed Teilhard de Chardin, it was what Tillich identified, this infinite and inexhaustible depth and ground of all matter. And that's what Teilhard, he recognized that the ground of all matter, that ground is God. So I'm just going to skip that, because I just want to go here, because this is going to give us a clue that when we speak about the ground or the depth of matter, we are speaking about something that's at once something that we ourselves are open to. This ground is part and parcel of our own lives. It is what Carl Jung would call the psyche, the realm of the unconsciousness. And I want to explore that tomorrow. What does that mean? To be in touch with the ground of our being. Meister Eckhart, of course, you know, in that famous saying, came into, and that's what attracts us to the mystics. They are deeply, they have made that journey through the levels of matter into the depths of the mind. Where God disappears and all that remains is this experience of the ineffable within themselves and around themselves. So the eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees me. Matter, mind, God. So our greatest adventure, I think, is to bring matter, mind, and the depth of mind, as that mind opens up to the fullness of light, which is God, into this place, into this movement of the whole, to become more whole until that fullness of light radiates throughout our being into that future fullness of life. Panikkar notes that the Sanskrit word for light is God. And there are studies today to really show that consciousness and light are synonymous, coterminous, which is very interesting, since light is, in a sense, what marks this universe. So we are entering into a new paradigm of cosmotheandric wholeness, meaning that we cannot separate God from matter. Matter matters to God. And therefore, if matter is a mirror of the mind, and if that depth of the mind, that which no greater can be thought is God, then God, matter, and mind form this integral whole. And that's our story. What does it mean to live in this wholeness of this wholeness that is pulling us on towards more wholeness? And it might sound redundant, but really what we are seeing here is that every experience is an experience of God. Everything I touch of God. Every thought that I have is, in a sense, an awakening towards something more of God. And so there's a God, mind, matter, whole cosmos in evolution. And each one of us is playing a unique role in this. We are each light, and yet we can't just extinguish one light or replace one light for another. Each person bears that light in a unique and irreproducible way. And it's the beauty of the human person as matter, human person as mind, the human person as feeling. This is the mystery of God here, right in our midst. We may be it. So I probably leave you with more questions than anything, but let's stop there. And maybe if we have a few minutes for some sharing, some thoughts, or anything you'd like to say. Yes, Kemi.
Thank you for an absolutely fascinating topic tonight. I happen to be a wellness coach, and in addition to my work here with the work, overlay that with some of the social science work that goes toward behavior change and motivation to greater well-being. And so my mind got caught on your concept or your thought on autonomy. And knowing that currently, and I'll say currently because of the trust that we are an evolving being, but our current understanding is that we are, our well-being is deeply satisfied when we are autonomous. And so how does that fit in, you know, as contributing to this wholeness and experience of connectedness to the whole, in inviting people to also have an understanding of their autonomy in relationship to that?
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. I would use a different word than autonomy. I think the concept is right, right? And maybe, you know, in other words, there's a unique wholeness to every person that you want to bring into that greater fullness. But the fact is that that wholeness is always we are never really autonomous, right? We're never really self-sufficient. In fact, it's precisely through the work of the group and through the interchange and through the exchange with others and the sharing, that interbeingness, that shaping that personhood. And so I would, language is really important at this point. And so we have to be careful, I think, about the language that we're using. Of absolutely, 100%, we want persons to be well, right? To be integrated, to be fully at home in themselves. But that process itself is an awakening to our deep connectivity.
Thank you for that clarification. That really helps.
Yeah. Thanks.
Ilya, we've probably come to the end, just about the end of our time for tonight, but there will be time for question and answers during the retreat portion of our time on Saturday. Sure. So we can serve this as a ferment, if you will, in our being for the next 2 days. But I do invite you to perhaps give us a closing word for the night.
Sure. And I'm happy to share the slides with you as well.
Oh, please do. Yes. Yeah. And we will post them in the archives.
My closing word. You know, as I was reflecting today on things, I was sitting in a pool and the sun was coming through the window. And I breathed in, and in one whole movement, the light, the water, my beingness, I just thought it was unspeakable joy. And that is, in a sense, what God is, unspeakable joy. In that moment, sometimes when we're not really praying formally or looking for God, how do we dwell, you know, to dwell in those unspeakable moments of joy?
Thank you, Ilya. What a wonderful way to go into the night. And we can sense from your being and radiance that this is truth. This is truth. Thank you very much for your presence among us, to be continued. So we close our night with prayer, as always, affirming aloud a prayer to God, to ourselves, to one another, that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully, and how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep, rest in Christ's peace.